This episode of Red Ink, we talk to a player from the 1986-87 Ashes series who played for England.
My name is Chris Broad, former England cricket international and opening batsman.
He was recently part of Audie's Inside the Tour podcast, which is about that series. And we got him on to discuss his career, moving counties, playing Malcolm Marshall, facing cricket's first unplayable left armour, Bruce Reid, Murph Hughes, playing cricket in South Africa during apartheid, and his fiery temperament. I want to talk about your batting, and that's why you're here. You had a very good debut season in first-class cricket. You made some runs against the universities. I think you averaged about 36 or 37. And then for about 3 years, you averaged around 30, 31, 29 even. Take me through that. Was that teams working you out, do you think, a little bit? Or just bad luck or bad pitches? Or what happened back then?
I'd like to think that you jump straight into first-class cricket and become a perfect player right at the start. But that doesn't happen, rarely happens, I think. As far as I was concerned, it was about working out what I was good at and what I wasn't good at. And, you know, averaging 30 is not bad. It's not great, but it clearly wasn't going to be searching international honours at that stage. So I think the first 3 years were just basically finding my feet.
You moved to Nottingham. How many years into your career was that?
So 5 years into my career, I decided that I was stagnating a little bit at Gloucester and needed a new challenge. And fortunately, various counties came in for my services, one of them being Nottinghamshire, and with the likes of Clive Rice as captain, Richard Hadley, Eddie Hemmings, future internationals such as Bruce French and Tim Robinson in the team, it looked like a side that was going somewhere and a real challenge for me to step up. And it was playing at a test match venue, which Trent Bridge is a magnificent venue. So for me, it was a no-brainer.
So I wondered how much it was about pitches, because when you look back at your record, for Gloucestershire, you averaged 31. Now, obviously, some of that was early on, but you went back there later on. And when you went to Trent Bridge, you averaged 42 for them. I think it was a Matthew Engel piece where he described you as quite ambitious. Were you thinking that you just had to sort of push your career forward a little bit at that point?
I needed a challenge. I like a challenge in everything that I do. And I needed at that stage, having found my feet a little bit in county cricket, I needed a challenge. I needed to be looked at as being something better than I actually was at that particular moment in time. You know, Trent Bridge was renowned in those days as being green and good pitches for fast bowlers. But actually, they were good pitches. They encouraged spin. There was some good bounce in there. Certainly, there was some sideways movement and good pace and bounce for the faster bowlers. But as a touch batsman, as I was, it was great for me because I was able to nick and nudge and build my innings around those sort of deliveries. So Trent Bridge was a perfect place for me, really.
And from there, you almost get picked to play for England very soon after making that move. You've been playing at Gloucester, and you go to Nottingham, you're still developing as a batter, clearly getting better at this point. You get picked to play for England, and your first test series is the Blackwash. I'll try and get the bowlers right. Malcolm Marshall, Eldon Baptiste, Joel Garner, Michael Holding, Winston Davis. It's a pretty good bowling attack. How do you prepare for that? You would have faced some of them in county cricket, I'm assuming, before, but not all in a group.
Yes, that's very true. A lot of West Indian bowlers were playing in county cricket and applying their trade during their wintertime in county cricket. And yes, I had faced pretty much most of them together. And facing a West Indies attack as a whole was a much bigger challenge. But I had a reputation of being able to play fast bowling reasonably well. And I think that's why I was selected in the first place. Whether I'd have been selected had I stayed at Gloucester, no one knows. But the fact that I'd started the season quite well at Trent Bridge, had this reputation of being good against the faster bowlers, I think got me selected.
Malcolm Marshall dismissed you 5 times in Test cricket. And I was doing a piece recently on R. Ashwin and how he's ruined left-handers' careers. So I think Steele Van Zyl averaged about 40 in Test match cricket and 3 against Ashwin. And again, Eddie Cowan was another player, had this decent average in Test cricket and then nothing against Ashwin. Malcolm Marshall is still arguably the most talented seam bowler that's ever existed, almost a complete package in many ways. That's a lot of times to go up against someone like that early in your career when you're only just discovering who you are as probably a test batter at that point.
Yeah, and I would rate him as being one of the best bowlers that I'd faced, along with the likes of Richard Hadley. For me, as an opening batsman, they were the real challenge because both had good pace. Both were able to get the ball to seam off the pitch. Malcolm was able to swing the ball as well and keep you on the back foot by bowling some mean bouncers as well. So he undoubtedly was, you know, one of the best bowlers that I faced.
Is that what made him so tough? Because you said there that he could seam it in both directions and he could swing it in both directions. But as good as Richard Hadley was, probably batters weren't as worried about being hit. And also because Malcolm Marshall was a little bit shorter, a bit like we saw with Dale Steyn, when he bowls the shorter ball, you can't really get out of the way of it because it skids. Is that the package or was there something else specifically that made him tough?
He was aggressive as well. I played with Richard Hadley and I got on quite well with Richard Hadley. I didn't know Malcolm Marshall, and he had that aggressive look about him, which made you think this bloke is after my head. And so it was a real challenge to play against him. And as I said right at the start, you know, I enjoyed a challenge. So, yes, I faced him a number of times, got out to him a number of times, but I also scored one or two runs against him as well. So it was a great battle.
So English cricket at that stage was fairly unprofessional. Obviously, the county system was a little bit more professional, but you were loaned to the England team to play. I think you averaged about 20 or 22 in that Blackwash series, which, I mean, it's called Blackwash, so, you know, we're not bearing the lead of what happened to England in that particular series. But what do you do as a professional at that stage? What sort of system is there to say you've just gone up against one of the greatest teams of all time and one of the greatest bowlers of all time? We haven't even mentioned Joel Garner, who I think is almost as good again. What do you do about your game? Because if you go back to county cricket, it's not really a like-for-like situation. So how do you sort of develop from there on in?
I mean, you say that. In those days in the 80s, the test arena was very similar to the county arena where, you know, you did turn up a couple of days before the test match. You got to know your teammates. You went out and you played cricket. You're right. By today's standards, it wasn't terribly professional. But of course, we didn't have hindsight in those days. You know, we went out there and we tried as best we could to show our skills and beat the opposition at the time. Admittedly, I think we set out as an England team not to lose the test match, whereas now test sides tend to set out in a test match how to win. So the mentality has changed. But, you know, we had some great individuals, but we were a particularly strong team at that moment in time. And so our challenge was not to lose.
But for you specifically, so you're thrown into this situation, you're still developing as a batter. What do you do after that series? Do you reevaluate your technique or do you say, do you know what? I did make some runs against, I think you made 55 in your first game. So yeah. As you said, it wasn't that you failed in every innings. You would have gone up against a great bowling attack. Did you have to rethink your game after that? Was it different to what you thought Test cricket was going to be?
Yes, it was different. How did I react to it? Well, I mean, I was left out at the end of that series, so didn't make the tour to India. So I had a winter at home, not doing anything and feeling a bit aggrieved that I had faced the West Indies and hadn't had the opportunity of going to India on tour. But that was the way the side was selected in those days. It was very much horses for courses. And I knew that I wasn't particularly good against spin. So I kind of accepted it and got on. And when the next county season came along, tried my best to score as many runs as I could again.
You played one more test, I think, between the two, the West Indies series and the Australian series. I think you played a one-off test against Sri Lanka and you made some runs there. As you say, you were left out. The next big sort of cricket you played outside of county cricket is you actually made the decision to go and play first-class cricket in South Africa for Orange Free State. How did that come about?
Largely because of Dr. Ali Bakker. He phoned up and asked if I would be available to go and play in Orange Free State. It was their first season in the A section of the Currie Cup over there. And because I wasn't doing anything that winter, it suited me down to the ground to go over and play some more first-class cricket and gain an experience of playing in a different country.
Was there any political ramifications at the time or was it controversial? Because it wasn't like the rebel players, you weren't representing a fake England team or anything. It's a bit different. There was a lot of players who went back and forth. Was there any pressure on you not to go?
Nope. At that stage, none whatsoever. It was myself going over to Orange Free State and playing first-class cricket.
You hadn't played cricket in Australia first class. Had you played any club cricket or anything in Australia?
I played down on the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria on Melthoid pitches for a team called Somerville.
Somerville? Oh, wow.
Way back in 79, something like that. So a long, long time before going there in 86, 7. But it was an interesting experience.
Incredible that you had to play in Somerville and your son had to play out in Hoppers Crossing and Werribee. You certainly picked two of the worst parts of Melbourne, and I'm allowed to say that because I'm from there. But my big question was, you go to South Africa and then obviously you turn up in 86, 87 in Australia. Did you feel a little bit more comfortable? Because obviously English pitches and playing very fast bowling is completely different to playing it in South Africa or Australia. Did that South African journey sort of really help you? I know you already said you're a good player of quick bowling, but this is a slightly different situation again.
I mean, I think over the years, having played on various different surfaces against various different attacks, it gives you the experience required to play in different venues. And I think having been to Australia before, left under a little bit of a cloud, I was looking forward to going back to Australia and actually scoring runs and doing as well as I can against an Australian team, which initially was in transition after they had lost a few players to a South African rebel team as well.
You said when you played against the West Indies that as a team, you were sort of thinking to yourself that you were trying not to lose. 86, 87, both of those England and Australian teams were in a sort of a weird space. Did you go over as a team thinking that you had a very good chance of beating Australia then?
To be honest, I was only just too delighted to be back in the squad. And I think every English cricketer's dream is to tour Australia. So for me, that was just a dream come true that I was on the plane going to Australia to play cricket. I didn't really think about what the result was going to be, you know, what my form was going to be. I was just fairly confident in my abilities on pitches over there that I was going to be able to score some runs.
You averaged 69.57, absolutely, you know, blitzed the series, made well over 400 runs. I want to take you through, you probably talked about the series a million times and the, you know, all the different stories. What I was really interested in is your plans for each bowler, because there's a couple of very good bowlers and a couple of very interesting bowlers that Australia had in their team. So for instance, Bruce Reid, people don't really remember him now outside of the 12th man tapes and his body falling apart. But Bruce Reid was really, even before Wasim Akram, maybe the prototype of modern left-arm bowlers. He was fairly fast, but also incredibly skillful, which a lot of left-arm bowlers weren't at that point. How did you plan for Bruce Reid? Because there wasn't really any Bruce Reids around before him.
Again, I think you're assuming that the plans that we put in place are akin to the plans that are put in place nowadays. You know,
I'm not. I was actually more thinking what you did once you saw him, because your cricket brain still would have had to tick over. I know it's not the same as what your son would go through, but what I mean is, like, once you've seen him a couple of times, you must be thinking, well, I will have to come up with a different method of playing against him than I would against other bowlers, because there aren't that many 6'7" left arm bowlers.
So, you know, I think from my point of view, the fact that he was tall, he was fairly gangly. I likened it a little bit to facing Joel Garner, who he got additional bounce out of pitches. And therefore, I was assuming that he was going to get some additional bounce. Okay, it's from a different angle, but you still had to be able to cope with someone who was going to get a little bit more bounce out of the pitches. He didn't swing the ball very much, so that was in my favor. And I think all left-handers have a little bit of advantage in that there were more right-handers facing the left-armers, and therefore my strength being on my legs, every time he erred in line, I was able to work him through the mid-wicket area. So, you know, I felt leaving the ball, I was always one who wanted the bowler to bowl to me, and if he bowled the ball outside the off stump, I believe that was wasted energy on his part, so I would leave it alone. Therefore, it encouraged him to bowl more at me, and I was able to work him off my legs more often than not.
So one of the other bowlers who is slightly more famous, although probably wasn't anywhere near as good a bowler as Bruce Reid, was Merv Hughes. It was a very young, interesting Merv Hughes that you went up against. He was basically almost an outswing bowler who tried to project a certain angriness without maybe having the pace to back it up. In some ways, he was almost like a traditional English bowler, but like, with more Australian anger sort of put into him. Is that a fair way that you sort of came across him?
Yes, I think so. But again, he was very early in his career and hadn't built up the confidence that we would see in years to come, and therefore tried to be aggressive on the field verbally as well as bowling wise. without having anything to back it up. And sure enough, in a couple of years' time, he was much more confident and a much better bowler and was picking up wickets on a regular basis. It was very early in his career that he faced us on this 86-87 tour.
When you faced him then, and I think he took his wickets at around 40, so he didn't particularly have a lot of success. Did you think that in the next couple of years he would be torturous to England batters, or were you thinking he was more hot air at that point?
To be honest, I wasn't projecting forwards at any stage. I was focused very much on this particular series and, you know, trying to do as well as I could against the bowling that was in front of me.
It's remarkable when you look at the sort of personalities from this particular Australian team. One of the other players was Greg Matthews, who you went up against. Now, he's an off-spinner and you're a left-hander. He would have been at least hoping to have some success against you. I don't think he took very many wickets at all in this series. Again, he would have been, I assume, quite vocal, as he tended to be. I don't think you even got dismissed against him. Did you find him particularly easy to face? Or,
you know, when you look at the pitches that we were playing on, Perth hardly moved off the seam or, you know, as a spinner off the pitch at all. Adelaide was very flat. Melbourne he played in, but of course they didn't get enough runs in the first innings, so we got a fairly big advantage and didn't bat in the second innings. And then I think he was left out in Sydney where Peter Taylor came in and he got wickets. So it was a funny one from Greg Matthews. Afterwards, I got on really well with him and I've had a good friendship with him ever since. But yeah, he was an interesting character on the field of play. Just a nice guy.
The other sort of main bowler that Australia had was Peter Sleep, which was the leg spinner. It's funny that you say that, you know, the pitches weren't in favour of the spin bowlers because Australia went with three spin bowlers in the series, as you mentioned. Peter Taylor came in, surprisingly, for that last test. Peter Sleep, I've always thought, had one of the most interesting actions of all time. There were so many moving parts coming in, but he was also a very, very good bowler and obviously went on to be quite a good coach in South Australia as well. How did you find facing someone like him?
I see, my strength is not against spinners, as I've pointed out, but as a leg spinner, I felt I didn't read him from the hand. I read him basically as the ball was coming down the pitch. So try to work out which way the ball was going to turn. And actually, I found him relatively easy to read. That doesn't mean to say that I'm going to come dancing down the pitch and smash him all over the place because I can read which way the ball's going to turn. Again, I was a nicker and nudger, so I was able to play the ball off the pitch, knowing roughly which way the ball was going to turn. So he didn't scare me a great deal. And, you know, again, the pitches, although they turn more for a leg spinner because they put more action on the ball, it didn't really bother me that much when he came on to bowl.
It was interesting when I went through the series, the bowler that dismissed you the most was Steve Waugh, who's probably the most almost traditional English bowler that Australia had in that particular lineup. But I'm assuming that's just because he was coming on at third and fourth change and you already made runs by that point. That particular series, it's why I want you on the podcast. There's obviously a very good podcast series that you're on at the moment, you know, about that 1986-87 series. That became sort of the high point of your career. Obviously, you went back to Australia, didn't you? And you made another 100 another time as well. But it's almost like your batting was really suited, I would assume, for Australian and South African pitches, maybe more so than some of the other pitches that you played around the world, not just because of the spin, but maybe just as a general rule. Is that fair to say?
Yes. I mean, I didn't score 100 in international cricket in England. And you would have thought, being an Englishman, I would know the English pitches better than I would know the overseas pitches. But you're right in your assessment that I actually preferred the pacier, bouncier pitches overseas than the sort of more green-seeming type pitches in the UK. Because I think it's down to technique. You know, my technique wasn't great. It was okay. I didn't enjoy the ball moving around that much. So with Australian and South African pitches, you know, I didn't move around very much and I was able to get away with a certain lack of technique, I suppose.
And as I said, that's kind of the high point of your career. You end up averaging 40. I think your test average is actually higher than your first class average. Usually when that happens, it means you either pick too late or you were dispatched off too early. I think in your case, it was quite clearly that you were dispatched off too early. I mean, if you look at what happened with English cricket from that period on, it wasn't like there were a lot of guys out there averaging 40 with the bat in test cricket. Obviously, you did have a bit of a form dip towards the end, but even so, it's always come about that that has a lot to do with the way that you behave, like you knocking the stumps down in Sydney and, you know, other moments where you showed dissent. Do you think that that is a legitimate reason why England moved on from you, your behaviour at that time?
I mean, it's difficult to know. I think we can all pick and choose players that we would have in teams, and they would vary massively. I think, as I said earlier on, the selectors were very much in a horses for courses type selection policy at that time. And it was really only David Graveney, some years after I left the scene, that decided that they would pick certain players and stick with them for a really good period of time. My test career was blighted by being selected and maybe not scoring as many runs as I would have hoped in two or possibly three matches and then getting left out. So, you know, whether my temperament, my passion for the game got the better of me and in the selectors' minds is a moot point and difficult to judge, really.
And when you look back on your international career, do you think that you were fulfilled or do you think that it was frustrating? You talked about coming in and coming out and maybe not getting longer runs.
I think had I worked at my game like a Graham Gooch worked at his game, I could have got better. I could have played more matches. I'm just delighted that I actually made it to the international level, the England level, and played for a number of years at that level and had some success at that level. So I can't decry the fact that I got left out. I just enjoyed my time at that level.
Before, just one last question. That Graham Gooch point is very important because obviously he went on to make himself into this incredible player. In some ways, he changed modern batting with the backlifts and all these different things. Do you feel like you played the game and perhaps maybe, you know, you had the ability to do more? You know, did you feel that it was, you know, more of a job? Were you of that kind of a professional or was it just you love playing cricket?
I love playing cricket. It wasn't a job for me. It was I enjoyed playing the sport and the bonus was that I got paid to play that sport. And to be honest, I've continued to be enjoying the sport that I'm involved in now. And it's never been a job. It's been a pleasure.
Beautiful. Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Cheers, Jared.
Thanks for listening. If you like cricket podcasts, it is worth listening to Audie's Inside the Tour podcast. If for no other reason, then the more support podcasts like this receive, the more likely people will make more of them into the future.
There is more information on my guests available in the show notes, including their Twitter profiles, if they have one. This is the important bit, though. Please review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere really. Share it on all the social medias and just get it out there. If you can, act it out in plays on your balcony with your loved ones. This podcast is made possible by the people who support us at Patreon, so thanks to those who already do. And there is a link to Patreon in the show notes as well. Red Inca is made by me, Jared Kimber. Nick McCorriston makes everything sound better for your ears, and the theme tune is called The Prisoner by the Red Crickets.